shall cross the barren desert, but you shall not die of thirst. You shall wander far in safety, though you do not know the way. You shall speak your word in foreign lands, and all will understand. You shall see the face.
Good evening and welcome to this year's Lenten Reflection in English. Tonight our guest is Reverend Dr. Jack Finnegan. Father Finnegan is a Salesian priest, spiritual director and lecturer and author. He is presently associate professor in the School of Spirituality at the Milltown Institute in Dublin, Ireland. I got to know Father Finnegan when I was reading for my Bachelor of Divinity course at the Milltown Institute, but unfortunately I did not have him as my teacher since he was teaching only students reading for the Master's course in spirituality. He specializes in contemporary spirituality and contemplative psychology. Veritas Press, Dublin, will soon launch his book, The Audacity of Spirit, The Meaning and Shaping of Spirituality Today. His other publications include contributions to edited collections in spirituality, including With Wisdom Seeking God, soon to be published by Peters, and Lamplighters, published by Veritas Press in 2004. Father Finnegan is presently serving as chair of the All-Ireland Spiritual Guidance Association and was founding chair of the National Association for Pastoral Counseling and Psychotherapy in Ireland. So, Father Finnegan, we thank you for accepting to come to speak to us. And I would like to say happy Paddy Day today. It's St. Patrick's Day. So I offered Father Finnegan a pint of Guinness, and he said he's a teetotaler. So we look forward to hearing what you want to say to us. Thank you very much.
I want to share a little scripture reflection before we start using the PowerPoint. And the scripture reflection is the first reading from St. Patrick's Day Mass, which I celebrated on Saturday, because the liturgical celebration of St. Patrick's Day was shifted to Saturday this year. However, the civil celebration is today. So no doubt the fact of Holy Week will have done nothing to the sale of Guinness, unfortunately, because St. Patrick's Day is about drowning the shamrock. And I don't mean drowning it with water. But I thought it would be nice if we just listened to this few verses from Sirach. In chapter 39, if the great Lord is willing, the scholar will be filled with the spirit of understanding. The scholar will pour forth words of wisdom and give thanks to the Lord in prayer. The scholar will direct counsel and knowledge aright, and meditate on scholarly secrets. The scholar will reveal instruction in his teaching and will glory in the law of the Lord's covenant. And I want to pause on that word, glory, and will glory in the law of the Lord's covenant. Anybody who has looked at the world of counseling and psychotherapy will realize that there are two human emotions which play dominant roles in human affairs and have a major impact on human health. The first is the emotion of fear, and the second is the emotion of joy. Fear organizes our neurology in one direction, and joy organizes our neurology in a very different direction. This is what Sirach is reminding us of. He's saying that unless we know how to glory in things, in other words, find joy in things, our lives are going to be characterized by fear and its siblings. It's going to be characterized by fear and anxiety. It's going to be characterized by anxiety, fear, and tension, and all of the things that go with that. Whereas if somebody is able to develop a life that is grounded in joy, in being able to be celebrative, is able to be imaginative and creative in his or her life, we're beginning to talk about somebody whose psychological well-being is assured, whose spiritual well-being is assured. And we know from the teaching of Jesus that love plays a central role here. Love is the cause of joy, even painful joy at times, but joy nonetheless. And love casts out all fear. And so as we enter into Holy Week and we look at a suffering Savior, and we look at depictions of the suffering of Jesus, I just want to pause and invite us to reflect on a very simple, very straightforward question. And I'm turning to 1 Kings. We have Elijah saying something very, very interesting in chapter 18 at verse 21. And Elijah came near to all the people and said, "How long will you go limping with two different opinions?" Now, Elijah was not talking about fear and joy, but it's easy to see how we could be living part of our life on the basis of fear, and then hopefully trying to live another part of our life on the basis of joy, and not coming to a single-minded position. And something similar is found in, I wrote it down here, just let me check in my little magic book. It's in Sirach, back to Sirach in chapter 2. "Woe to timid hearts and to slack hands, and to the sinner who walks along two ways. Interesting notion again, isn't it? Somebody walking on two ways. Now again, Sirach was probably not thinking about fear and joy here, but it's easy to see how that incapacity to bring my life into a wholeness, into a oneness, into a unity, can become a profoundly upsetting and disturbing force in anybody's life. In other words, we have to make a choice. And I think Holy Week is a week for doing that. And the choice somehow or other is between a life grounded in fear or a life grounded in joy. I was just chatting with a young friend over here who's in first year medicine. And I was telling him that in the study of meditation today, we are making use of brain scanning techniques and neurological researches. And one of the things that's very interesting about certain forms of meditation is that when they're practiced on an ongoing basis, the happiness centers in the brain are switched on and never switch off. So I'm going to say to you, there's good medical reason for practicing meditation. There's a sense in which if we are to understand spirituality today, it's not enough to engage with philosophy and theology. We have to engage with neurology and biology as well, because the higher states that we talk about in spirituality are all grounded in lower level processes within the body and within the brain, within the functioning of the central nervous system. Let me finish my little neurological side trip by telling you about another piece of research in spirituality done, if my memory serves me right, in Northwestern University in the US, looking at a particular meditative technique developed in Tibetan Buddhism. In Tibetan Buddhism, anger is seen as negative, a negative force. In the West, we have a more, I think, a sophisticated view of anger, because we see anger as something that's also appropriate, not necessarily exaggerated, but it may be appropriate and it may be just. And a lot of people who are activists for justice and equality are being, as it were, motivated by a just anger. However, in the Buddhist tradition, in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, that point of view does not hold. And as a result, methods of meditation have been developed which are intended to remove anger. And what has become very interesting about this is that this meditative technique produces high levels of endorphins within the human system. And this has explained something very intriguing. A lot of lamas who would have been using this method of meditation over long periods of time have diabetes. And one of the causes of diabetes is higher levels of endorphins within the system. So that the meditative technique that on the one side is removing the intensity of anger, and the other side is creating a predisposition towards diabetes. And that this is one of the ways I try to tell my students not to think that spirituality is always good. If spirituality isn't grounded in a serious understanding of the human person, because spirituality is what we do as human beings. Holiness is what God does. Spirituality is the way we live it ourselves. It's built on our choices. It's built on the commitments we make. And it's built on an understanding. I suppose if I was to put this in a theological way, it's built on an understanding of the incarnational principle. Jesus isn't just divine, he's also human. And spirituality respects that human side. and wants to understand it as fully and as profoundly as possible. And so this is one of the reasons why I chose as my theme for these three evenings together the theme of transformation. And I want to define spirituality as a path of transformation. But to engage with a path of transformation is to begin to make transformative choices. To begin to make transformative choices means understanding the resistance to change that is built into every one of us. It's as if we have two immune systems. One, an immune system that fights disease, and the other, an immune system of a more psychological kind that fights change. You know, we're always making good resolutions, aren't we? But so very often nothing very much comes from it. And so I want to say something to you that I find profoundly liberating. And it's this: change usually happens because we have no other choice. If we have to walk away from fear, I have to make the choice to embrace joy. If I am to live a more healthy, more holistic life, I have to make the choices that allow me to do that. One of my old teachers, an American psychologist, Arnold Mindell, would make the point that few people voluntarily join the growers club. And what he means is people choosing to grow, people choosing a path of transformation and change. Very few voluntarily do it. Most change comes about because of what Arnold Mindell, Jack Mesereau in the States, an educational scholar in the States, describes as a disorienting dilemma. Transformation happens because the assumptions I've been working with collapse and no longer work for me. So I have to, as it were, trade them in and get some new assumptions. That's what allows transformation to take place. I have to look at my perceptions. I have to look at my presuppositions. And I have to allow them to change. I have to recognize when they're no longer working. Because when they're no longer helping me to understand reality and to make sense of reality, they're going to be part of the problem, not part of the solution. So one of the things I'll be asking you to do as part of your participation in these three evenings is to begin to reflect on your assumptions, to begin to reflect on your presuppositions. And Holy Week is a delightful time to do that. If you think about it, the disciples all had assumptions about Jesus. And then this week arrived. And what happened? They were all thrown into a crisis. They all ran into a disorienting dilemma and pretty much ran away. They had been walking one path when they arrived in Jerusalem, and by Friday they were walking its opposite. They were walking an entirely opposing path. And that's the human story. That's my story. That's your story. We're people of two opinions. We're people who walk, or at least we try to walk, two paths. And we get hurt in the process. I'm thinking of Peter denying Jesus three times. I'm thinking of a cock crowing. These are all icons of challenge, a challenge towards awareness, a challenge towards a deeper self-understanding, challenge towards taking the commitment to be a follower of Jesus seriously, allowing it to take me into places perhaps that I would not have chosen personally to go, to taking up stances that perhaps if I was fearful I would not take up. But because I'm somehow or other being touched by a joyfulness, a courage comes to bear. And because I am more joyful than fearful, I'm ready to stand up and be counted and to move things forward. I'd like to invite you to spend a few moments now in quiet reflection as we put some slides up on the screen to help us to begin to enter into the challenge of transformation as it is presented to us by imagery representing Holy Week, particularly Friday. It's a rather interesting picture, isn't it? When I showed that picture to some of my friends recently, they thought it was a picture of the Holy Spirit. But in fact, it's the crucified Lord with his arms pulled back, his head down. And if we go back to the previous one, I think this is a commentary on the contemporary situation in many ways. There's crucifixion, but it's obscured. Its meaning is obscured. Europe is a very interesting place to live and to study spirituality, because Europe is going in the exact opposite direction to the rest of the world. In the rest of the world, religion and spirituality are on the increase. In Europe, things are going in the opposite direction. And so I think in some ways that's an icon of the present situation that we meet all around us on a European basis. And yet the statistics in Europe are very strange. It shows you the problem of working at a statistical level. Religious practice has never been so low in Europe, and belief in God has never been so high. It's confusing the living daylights out of sociologists who invented the secularization theory to explain what would happen in modernity as modernity got a stronger and stronger grip, that inevitably religion would disappear. It's not happening in the rest of the world, not even in the United States. It's happening in Western Europe. Or at least, it seems to be happening until you look at some of the statistics. However, one of the things I think we can say is that Europe at the moment is a Europe of two opinions. It's a Europe that's trying to walk on two quite different paths. And I don't know what the outcome will be. However, the statistics are very interesting. It looks as if spirituality and religion are making a comeback in France. It looks as if they're making a comeback in Italy. In other countries, they're making a downturn. So the statistics are not painting an even picture. They're not even painting a simple picture. They're painting a very complex one. And it's an important thing for us who would consider ourselves Christians to take seriously. In a postmodern world, all institutions become suspect. And in a context in which a suspicion of institutions, not just religious institutions, but institutions of any kind, is becoming suspect, the role of the individual who lives a coherent and a congruent Christian life becomes all the more significant and all the more important. And so, in a Europe that is emphasizing
the individual and individualism and individualistic approaches to life, the individual Christian becomes vitally important. The quality of the life of the individual Christian becomes vitally important and vitally significant. And that's another reason why I wanted to address the concept of transformation in these conversations. I'm used to teaching adults, and I like it when I'm interrupted. So if anybody has any questions they want to ask me at any point, or indeed to disagree with me at any point. After all, we are in a postmodern world, and there's more than one opinion about most things. So if there's anything anybody would like to hear a little more on, or to clarify, or to inquire into more fully, I'd be happy to hear from you. Okay? Take that as a real invitation. I want to move into the more, shall we say, challenging part of my conversation with you this evening. This is Wittgenstein's Duck Rabbit. I'm sure all of you have come, well, most of you have come across it at some point or other. Is it a duck? Is it a duck or is it a rabbit? Which is it? Well, it depends on how you look at it, doesn't it? Yes. So it really builds into what I was saying about walking two roads or walking two opinions. Is it a duck or is it a rabbit? And it's also helping us to understand that we do have preconceived ways of seeing things. Now, some people will see ducks all the time there, and other people will see rabbits. And those of us who are really wise see both of them at the same time. You see, because we've learned the trick. We've begun to understand that everything isn't as I see it. You get three people looking at the same thing, and they'll see three different things when you get the descriptions of it. Those of you who are in the counseling and psychotherapy worlds know that when you interview members of a family, it's as if they all had a different father and a different mother. Even though that's certainly not the case in objective reality. But the subjective reality goes all over the place. And in a sense, that's what Wittgenstein was trying to help people to see when he came up with this rather interesting design, which has begun to be called a hyper-icon. A hyper-icon in that it lifts you out of your normal way of seeing things. There's a bunch more of them. Imagine having wallpaper like that. Now, in this hyper-icon, what are we supposed... Now I'm making a shift. I'm not asking you to what we're supposed to see, but what we're supposed to believe. Because if I believe it's a duck, that's all I will see. If I believe it's a rabbit, that's all I will see. So we're now moving away from seeing things to what we believe about the things we see. Now I want to just pause here for a moment. We see the world through sets of assumptions. Every one of us, we have assumptions about ourselves. We have assumptions about the people that are part of our lives. Everything is based on assumptions. These assumptions generate presuppositions. Presuppositions generate biases. When I get an assumption that has turned into a presupposition that has generated a bias, and I'm doing this over a period of time, I end up with a habit of mind. And if I have a habit of mind, I have a set of expectations based on the habit of mind. So somebody lets me down, I feel all upset. But the person doesn't know they let me down. They didn't even know that I had a set of expectations grounded in a bias, grounded in a presupposition, grounded in a and an assumption. And that's what makes transformation possible. My expectations get knocked. And as a result, if I am a reflective person, if I'm capable of sitting down for a few minutes reflectively and doing it critically meaning that I'm asking myself serious questions, why do I feel that he or she let me down? And I begin to notice that that's coming from something inside myself, a habit. And then I begin to ask myself whether this habitual way of seeing the world actually works, or whether it has anything whatsoever to do with the world, or to do with people. You begin to see where I'm going with this. Transformation happens to the extent that assumptions are changed, that presuppositions are changed, that the habits of mind that generate our world of expectations, the expectations we impose on other people. Transformation requires that all of that be opened up. If I'm going to become a follower of Jesus, I need to look at my expectations about what that means. I have to ask myself then, what are my assumptions about what it is to be a Christian? What are my assumptions? What are my presuppositions? What are my biases? And if I am willing to do this, if I'm willing to ask myself these kinds of very basic questions, I begin to encounter my rigidities. One of the reasons why we do not allow our assumptions to be challenged is because we don't know who we are beyond those assumptions. And we imprison ourselves in those assumptions. We become captured by them. Jesus says, I came that they may have life and have it to the full. Jesus says, the truth shall set you free. We are not meant to live rigidly captured lives. We're meant to live lives that are moving all the time towards the indeterminate reality that is God. God cannot be rigidly tied down to anything. We know that theoretically, don't we? But we need to be able to say, so why am I doing this to my brothers and my sisters? Why am I putting my brothers and my sisters into rigid slots? One of the things I often ask people on retreats to do is to make a list of, I can't stand people who. And every one of those will tell you about an assumption or a presupposition or a bias or an expectation that you have never examined. It's even more interesting to do a second list, which is, I love people who. So there are positive assumptions and negative assumptions, positive biases and negative biases, and they're all part of our ability or our inability to live together. I was just talking the other day to one of my students who was telling me a story about a bereavement, and this was the second of the two parents in a family who had died. And within weeks of the death of the mother, the father had died several years before, but within weeks of the death of the mother, there was a horrible row going on in the family about inheritances. What was the row based on? Expectations. What were the expectations based on? Assumptions. Do you see where we're going with this? If we don't understand this basic criterion of change, that change for the better means changing assumptions that are holding me back. If we look at that, what meanings are disseminated by it? If you were to ask yourself, if you were really to play with this duck, rabbit, Do you think I've pulled out the meaning sufficiently? Would you agree with me that we do see things the way they aren't, and we do see things differently to other people, but that if I'm really on a journey with Jesus, I'm on a journey that's leading to a place of compassion, I'm on a journey that's leading to a place of love, I won't be making judgments. In spirituality, in ethics, in theology, in philosophy, judgment and compassion are opposites. If I'm a compassionate person, I won't be making judgments about other people. However, if I'm a wise, compassionate person, I will also know the difference between making judgments and evaluating. Because to be compassionate doesn't mean to be stupid. Whatever about not making judgments, I know that one and one in most circumstances makes two. And if somebody, what's the old saying, if I trust you once and you let me down, it's your fault. But if I trust you twice and you let me down, it's my fault. Do you see? So you learn, you evaluate, but you do it in a respectful, compassionate way. And this is what it is. I think most of us have a highly developed capacity for judgment. But we haven't got anything like as highly developed a capacity for compassion. Would you agree with that? One of my friends who's a very highly experienced clinical psychologist would make the point that it's because we lack a fluidity of awareness around cultural symbolism. And we confuse our faith, our religious faith, with our cultural faith. Can I give you an example of what I mean by this? Stigmata occur in Catholic circles. They don't occur in Protestant circles. Why is that? Is it because God only gives the stigmata to Catholics and not to Protestants? Well, that's not a very good thing to say, is it? The real reason is that the stigmata is a strong element in Catholic symbolism. And so somebody who's trying to explain their suffering to themselves and spiritualize it is likely to head in the direction of the stigmata. Who was the first person to have the stigmata? After Jesus, I mean. It looks as if it was Francis of Assisi. So it means 1,000 years had passed and this phenomenon wasn't part of Christianity. Catherine of Siena would have been another prominent saint. And in more recent years, if you exclude Padre Pio, all of the candidates for stigmata were women, which is rather interesting. In other words, even a question of stigmata raises cultural symbolism. Entering into a person's psychology and their spirituality and impacting on their neurology and their biology. It's quite intriguing, isn't it? And we need to understand that. So to what extent, when I'm talking about religion, am I in fact talking about culture? And I'm not able to make an evaluation of where culture ends and authentic religion begins. It's an interesting question, isn't it? And that leads me to the third question. How is meaning? And in a sense, at the beginning I said spirituality is a path to transformation. If it isn't, it's not spirituality, it's something else. If my spirituality is not having an ongoing transformative impact on my life, it's not spirituality. What would we call it if it's not spirituality? Piety? Some sort of devotionalism? That is self-referred. You see the problem? A lot of what looks like spirituality, sounds like spirituality, isn't spirituality because it's self-referred. A lot of piety is self-referred. Transformation begins when I stop being self-referred and I begin to open up to the other. For example, I begin to look beyond the duck and see the rabbit. Or I begin to look beyond the rabbit and I see the duck. And so that is the question I think that takes us to the deep level where transformation becomes a real challenge. What is the generative potential of the hyper icon? What does it generate? If I'm looking at Wittgenstein's, at least it's making me question what I see, isn't it? At least that. So that what makes transformation possible is whatever generates a question. And if I'm open, I will allow that question to arise. And I will wrestle with that question. I will allow that question to touch me and engage with me, and I'll engage with it. In other words, if my spirituality isn't making me ask questions about myself, about my relationships, about the world in which I am trying to live, about the community, the family in which I am living out my life, and I'm not asking questions about the quality of my presence, then, you know, what is being generated? Let me give you another example of what I have at the back of my mind here. You're with a group of people and somebody walks in and the whole place brightens up and everybody starts to smile because the person walking in has a very positive effect on everybody. We all know people like that, don't we? And then there's the other example of somebody walks into the group and everybody tries to leave as fast as they possibly can because the second person brings everything into a sudden decline. Here's the question. Am I a carrier of fear or am I a carrier of joy? Am I a carrier of a joy that heals and lifts up or am I a carrier of a fear that's toxic and pulls down? I need to know this about myself. If I notice several times that people start walking away when I start getting close to them, I need to ask, what am I doing to them? Not what are they doing to me? What does their movement towards me say? What does their movement away from me say? It's all information, isn't it? Somebody on the path of transformation is allowing relationship itself, the field of relationship itself, to be a source of information. And it's a piece of information about how I am impacting on them, how I am impacting on you. I don't know if you know the saying, we have an old saying in Dublin, he has a face only a mother could love. Do you follow me? Yeah. You know, is that what we're talking about? You know, unless the only one who loves me is my mother, and even she has problems with it, you know. Yeah. Whereas the other person who is able to lift up the whole atmosphere in a place is a very different kind of person. And so that's what I mean by a hyper icon, and that's what we mean by it in when we're talking about it in spirituality. It's a kind of summary image encapsulating a theory of knowledge. And what's the theory of knowledge, do you think, in this? Well, it's very simple. It's that, hey, things aren't necessarily what they seem to be, that we need to take a more open, we need to be ready to ask questions. Yes, continue. So the fourfold process of being and becoming today, this is another way of looking at a hyper icon. Do you see that? You see the picture? You see the four interlocking circles? You see the kind of egg that emerges in the middle? Do you see the flames that are depicted around it? This is an image based on a piece of that art that's associated with Blake. Do you remember Blake, the English poet, artist, Blake? So the fourfold process begins to look something like this. Birth, creativity, technology, and death. I'm going to pose a question. Every one of us has experienced all four of these, isn't that right? We've all been born. We may not remember what it was like to be born. We're all going to die. We all have a sense of creativity, and we're all consumers of technology. However, there's more going on in that fourfold reality than meets the eye. What about the political agendas of techno-economic power elites? There's a question for you. Most of the world today is being organized in favor of techno-economic power elites. They have the technology, they have the economic wherewithal, and they have the power. I had an old history professor, still alive, but well into his 90s at this stage, and still as bright as a button. And he said, you know, there are only two ways of controlling human populations: through prosperity or terror. Think about it. Interesting, isn't it? Through prosperity or terror. And it looks as if prosperity is the more efficient way of controlling populations. Because every time people have tried to control populations through terror, it tended not to work very well, because it was usually followed by a revolution. It's rather intriguing, isn't it? Another one of his lovely sayings was, the man who has read only one book probably read the wrong book. I like that. You like that? It's nice, isn't it? But we need to understand that so much of our life is associated, and certainly spirituality, if we understand it at a deep enough level, is about what sort of assumptions I have around birth, what sort of assumptions I have around death, what sort of assumptions I have around creativity, and what sort of assumptions I have around technology, and the way they interrelate. If they were to come together in pairs, what sort of egg would they lay? If we bring birth and creativity together, what would the egg be? If we brought technology and death together, what sort of egg would it be? If we look at the history of the 20th century, it becomes quite clear that we are the inheritors of the most bloody century the world has ever known. 65 million people at least killed in wars in the 20th century alone, not to mention millions of others that we know nothing about. And that was because somehow or other technology ended up in the service of a techno-economic power that led masses of people to death. Now, in a world in which there is an alliance between death and technology, what must spirituality do? What sort of challenge of transformation do we need to allowed to touch us? I think it has to do, does it not, with a creativity that brings things to birth. So I need to say, look, am I allowing my creativity to bring things to birth? Am I allowing my life to have a creativity that touches other people for the better? What egg do we as individual Christians seek to lay as local churches? What sort of eggs do we seek to lay for the world? I'll just put some arrows in there, just hit the next one as well. And you can see what I'm beginning to try and say here. And again, there's something of the hyper icon. Am I looking at a duck or am I looking at a rabbit? Except one of them is mechanical and can be used destructively. An interesting photograph, isn't it? A bit of composite photography. What's lurking outside the window? What's lurking outside the window? So is my spirituality creating a lurking death? Or is my spirituality generative? Is it generating a capacity for life? Now, we're back now to our four circles, but to raise another point. Go on ahead. Yeah. Show a birth. Do the four of them, yes. We've already looked at the link between technology and death. Now, where is the transformative potential of death? Ah, you see, this is where the Christian view of death becomes very intriguing. Because when I was speaking a moment ago, I was looking at death as the end of things, as a disaster. But in Holy Week, we begin to understand that death isn't always what it seems to be. The death of Jesus isn't the end, but a beginning. But this means that I have begun to understand that there is a creative side to a dying. What is it Jesus says in terms of his teaching about discipleship? If you would be my disciple, you must deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me. Let the dead bury the dead. And this is, you must die to yourself. So there's a kind of dying that's part and parcel of an embracing of transformation. A dying to what? A dying to what lacks integrity. A dying to what lacks creativity. A dying to what lacks that which lifts up. A dying to that which casts down. And I want to suggest to you that, and tomorrow we look at it a little more fully, that one of the languages we all speak perfectly is the language of blame. We speak a language called blame. If I want to become a transformed person, I have to unlearn the language of blame. Let me put it to you like this. It takes no intelligence whatsoever to blame somebody else on everything that's going wrong in my life. You don't even need to be on an IQ of anything very much, because we learn it from the time we're tiny little infants. It's as if we learn the language of blame before we learn our mother tongue. Or maybe blame is, in some sense, our father tongue. Let's not blame mothers on everything. And so, in a sense, what I'm suggesting to you is that contemplating the death of Christ means that this arrangement, this fourfold arrangement, takes on a different capacity. And so the question is, does this hyper icon generate a creative understanding of Christ's death? How can I change the way in which human beings use technology so that it's in the service of life rather than in the service of death? Can I do that? Do I have a space where I could even do that? Now, very often we have people saying, yeah, but I'm only one person. But you see, if enough one persons did something, you'd have millions doing it. So I would ask you not to use that language anymore. I'm only. What can I do? The answer is, if you change, something has changed. If individuals change, something has changed. I'll finish for tonight. How is time? Are you okay?
I'm just... We were supposed to finish at? 8:30.
I'm like this. I can talk forever. But the point I'm trying to make is that we need to ask ourselves a very important question. And it's this. Do I want a better world or not? And if I do, then what am I prepared to change in me to make the little world in which I live better? And my concluding example is an experiment that happened in Washington, D.C. Last year, to have a look at the impact that spirituality can have on a locality. A group of 30 people were invited to come together every day between certain hours of the day and meditate and pray about peace. And they did it for a week. And during that week, the crime figures decreased. And a whole range of other social indicators also improved. Next week, they went back the way they were. Now, the moral of the story is, if you're going to pray for peace, keep it up. Do you follow me? Because seemingly, prayer and meditation has a measurable effect in the locality where it is taking place. And I think that's a good point on which to end this evening, isn't it? That spirituality is about living something in the knowledge that as I live it with as much integrity as I can, it spills out beyond me. It has an impact in the locality where I live. Spirituality is always geographical. It happens in real geographical places, and it's always cultural. It happens in cultural contexts. And it has a capacity to change the world. Let's, as we go home tonight, I'd ask you to reflect on birth and death and creativity and technology, which are part and parcel of the world in which we live, and how do I want them to be arranged? Do I want them to be arranged in such a way that things are lifted up? Or am I happy to leave them the way they are with Darfurs and God knows what else going on the globe? Mary, help of Christians, pray for us.
The mountain.